This is Audible.
Fifty Shades of Hell, Book 2, in Lucid Dreams and Spiritual Warfare. Written by Maria Isabel Vita. Copyright 2017 by Maria Isabel Vita. All rights reserved. This is a novel, but also reality. People and events are fictionalized, but the experiences are true to life. A special thank you to a dear friend who wishes to remain anonymous for letting me include two of his dreams. All of Mary's dreams are actual dreams I have had. Read by Maria Isabel Vita. Chapter 1. Cairo is full of bridges and fishermen. And for many of the poorest residents of Egypt's capital, breakfast sometimes consists of freshly caught fish with a disposable side of garbage, also a common sight on the banks of the Nile. From before the rising of the sun to its setting, from shores, boats, and every level of the many bridges, fishing lines are hopefully flung. Not that I'm ever up before dawn, but Steve often is, and he likes to tell me about all the interesting things he sees and people he meets. Steve is my new boyfriend, and the most beautiful guy in the whole world. I imagine most girls feel that way about their boyfriends, so maybe it's a universal truth, and we're all correct. I arrived in Cairo less than 2 weeks ago. I never realized how much could happen in so little time. The same is true for my best friend forever, Carol. She's been in Egypt nearly 7 months, but in that time, she's managed to get pregnant and engaged in that order. Her fiancé is her boss, a drop-dead gorgeous Egyptologist who looks like he should have studied the Vikings instead. He and my friend slept together because they just wanted to be friends. Yes, you heard that right. They had some crazy idea of getting it over with, so they could work together on photographing Old Kingdom tombs without any distractions. Well, it all worked out okay, just not how they had planned. I'm giving a lot of thought to plans these days. Before I came to Egypt, I'd had only one plan, to come to Egypt. One step up, I guess, from being a baby in the womb who doesn't even plan on being born because he or she already feels it has everything. I'm glad I don't remember being grabbed by the head and pulled out into a whole new kind of world. It's no wonder our first breath is followed by screams of protest. The thing is, part of me feels a little like an infant, because I have also been pulled into a whole new world with mysterious laws and possibilities I can scarcely begin to grasp yet. I'm beginning to wake up in a lot of ways, including in my dreams. In the short time since I landed in the ancient land of the pharaohs, I have become a lucid dreamer. A lucid dream is a dream during which you realize you're dreaming and can take it from there into amazing, fully conscious experiences. Steve is also a lucid dreamer. He's been lucid dreaming for years, since he was 17. He's 24 now, and Italian on his father's side. Tall, with lean muscles, broad shoulders a pharaoh would have envied, short black hair, and deep brown eyes, much like an ancient Egyptian's. Looking at him makes me feel the ancient past is still very much alive in the present. In one sense, this is literally true, because Steve is a Christian, or as he puts it, a disciple of Christ. He wasn't raised Catholic. His mother is a Buddhist, and his police officer father seems to believe only in earthly laws. Steve's faith in Jesus Christ came as a result of his lucid dreams. My own parents, God bless them, whether they believe in him or not, are both agnostic attorneys. These two words go suspiciously well together. But my mom doesn't just read contracts. She also devours books on just about every subject, nonfiction and novels. She's exceptionally tall and skinny, and wearing her favorite light green robe, holding a book up in both hands, she reminds me of a praying mantis we kept in a terrarium in third grade, which placidly consumed anything edible we put in front of it. He would think that after reading so many books, she would have made a case by now for a specific belief system regarding her existence, but she only seems to believe in books. To me, that seems like collecting all the necessary materials, yet never building a home you can actually live in and enjoy all the beautiful views from. I also love to read, especially about ancient civilizations, beginning with Egypt's. But the book I've begun reading now is bigger and heavier in every sense than any other, and not just because I'm reading the print version. Fortunately, Steve asked me to begin near the end, which for Christians is the real new beginning. He also urged me to read only a few paragraphs every day, sipping the contents, like we both do the red wine we enjoy drinking with dinner. He explained to me that the Gospels, a Greek word that means good news, are alive with the Spirit of God, and so have the power to speak personally to every soul who opens their heart and mind to his living word. My maternal grandparents had been Catholics, but they died when I was very young, and the Holy Bible is the only book not in my parents' immense library. It was a relief to me that my homework as the girlfriend of a Catholic had, at least for now, been cut down to just the New Testament, where Jesus was. But who was Jesus, really? There was no doubt he was a historical figure, but that was all I knew for certain. I knew who I hoped he was, and so I felt both glad and trapped by my promise to read the Gospels from start to finish. Steve, Stefano Guardini, his legal and baptismal name, is the smartest, nicest, to the point of chivalrous, and universally most efficient guy I have ever met. He is also an archaeologist with a minor in ancient studies and a graduate degree in ancient Near Eastern and Egyptian studies. If Steve believed in the Bible, I was willing to suspend my own disbelief and read it with an open mind and heart. And my dreams were helping me with this intention. Every time I opened the book, I remembered the dream I'd had in a mastaba on my first morning in Egypt. The atmosphere in that dream had been pure love, the love I felt emanating from the man I had seen silhouetted against a bloody sky, and the love I felt for him in return. The sense of how much we loved each other was infinitely more than romantic. It was everything. What I had experienced made more sense to me when Steve told me that when his disciples asked Jesus what the greatest commandment was, he replied, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength." For this perfectly described how I had felt about the man in my dream. I was staying with Carol in her Garden City apartment. Of course, it wasn't actually hers. It belonged to a Matthew J. Waters, a mysterious friend of her fiancé who was away for a year. For the time being, Carol had also inherited Matthew's driver and maid, a very friendly older Egyptian couple. Although Hamoud also had two other wives, I only ever saw Azzi, as Carol fondly called her. At first, I was tempted to hide my Bible in the top drawer of the nightstand, but immediately decided against it. The seed of faith I felt germinating within me was, I told myself, nothing to be ashamed of. On the contrary, so I placed the heavy book on the table beneath the window. It was on this same table that I had found a blank envelope containing the photo of an Old Kingdom cartouche Carol and I figured out contained the name Imhotep. This photo no longer existed. Highly dramatic circumstances had driven me to toss it into a fire, which had been burning in the courtyard of a tomb Carol, Steve, Simon, and I were spending the night in, or at least my companions did, but I was carried away on horseback by the rich and infamous Sir Richard Ashley, also known as that devil and bastard in Simon's mental thesaurus. Personally, I was still on the fence about this magnetically attractive and definitely eccentric Englishman, who at the moment was directing a documentary for the History Channel about ancient Egyptian queens. He had even offered me the starring role playing Hatshepsut Maat Kare, the female pharaoh. I had turned it down. Whenever I woke up in the middle of the night, part of me still couldn't believe I'd done that. It had something to do with the fact that no one I trusted and liked trusted Richard. And there was also that little matter of suspecting he had drugged me. It was more than a suspicion now. Whenever I thought about falling off that horse into his arms and remembering scarcely anything else until I woke up in the morning, lying naked in a king-size bed inside a room decorated like an ancient Egyptian tomb, I was sure the sweet smell that rose before my face as we rode beneath the shadow of a pyramid had not been the ghost of ancient incense, but some kind of modern drug. My friends were right. Richard was a liar. And yet he also was, or so he said, a lucid dreamer. The first night we met in the Khan el Khalili Bazaar, as if by accident, he had urged me to remember my dreams. Then, when he locked me up for a day in that tomb-like room, he told me we had really first met in a dream, where I had told him I was coming to Egypt. At the time, I couldn't believe him. But since then, Steve and I had apparently met in a dream. So was it possible Richard was telling the truth? And yet the two times I remembered seeing him in a dream, he had not been very pleasant, and that was putting it mildly. If in reality he believed I was literally his dream girl, why did he behave with so much condescending hostility toward me in my dreams? Was it simply because in waking life I didn't trust him? Standing at the table in front of the window in the guest room, with my right hand I lightly caressed the beautiful violet leather Bible Steve had bought for me. I wished I could put the matter of Richard Ashley to rest, but it seemed he would not be set aside so easily. It disturbed me that he seemed able to read my mind. Or was it that the thoughts of an 18-year-old girl were not that hard to guess? But it still made no sense why he was so obsessed with me, at least not on a superficially rational level. He seemed genuinely driven to pursue me. Once again, I was wasting time pondering his motives, which was keeping me from my true purpose in those moments, to open the Bible and read a passage from the Gospels. I had marked the place where I had left off near the beginning of Matthew, but now I impulsively opened the New Testament to a random location. The first words I saw were, "Stay alert. Watch out for your great enemy, the devil." 1 Peter 5:8. I gasped, even as my rational brain insisted it was just a coincidence. But in my heart, I knew better, for ever since I could remember, I had believed in what Carol and I called the magic pattern. When I had tentatively told Steve about it, he said it was like Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity, a term he created to express the acausal connection of two or more psychic and physical phenomena. In short, meaningful coincidences. I'd heard of Jung and seen some of his books in my parents' library, and it was nice to learn that a famous psychoanalyst recognized the existence of the magic pattern. I had been thinking of Richard, and I had opened the Bible to a warning to watch out for the devil. Okay. I closed the book and again opened it at random somewhere in the New Testament. This time, the first words my eyes fell on were in red, which meant it was Jesus speaking. "When he lies, it is consistent with his character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." John 8:44. Okay, the magic pattern, synchronicity, meaningful coincidence, whatever. The fact was, I had just received a disturbingly coherent message. Stay alert. Watch out for your great enemy, the devil. When he lies, it is consistent with his character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. I breathed, "Thank you," and very respectfully closed the Bible, feeling it might truly be alive, and in an intensely personal way. Such directness, such perfect synchronicity between my train of thought and the responses I received from the first sentences that caught my eye blew my mind. I felt Jesus had actually entered the room and spoken to me. Yet I didn't want to think about it. I wanted to hold the experience very close to my heart, to treasure it in silence, keep it a secret, even from parts of myself. Chapter 2. I find myself behind the wheel of a large SUV, confidently pulling out into an intersection to turn right, but I'm too far to the left, blocking traffic. Flooring the accelerator, I manage to avoid a collision and make it through the intersection. Even though it isn't the way I was planning to go, I'm pleased to find myself on a straight and traffic-free highway stretching through open green pastures. I sense Carol sitting in the back seat. Glancing to my left, I see golden brown mountains in the distance. They are part of the scenery and yet somehow also separate from it, like a giant painted mural. I tell Carol, "This is a dream." I keep driving, but the scene darkens, and by the time I come to a large red brick building that looks familiar, night has fallen. The car just stops in the spacious area fronting two sides of the building that looks like it might be a church. As we pulled up, we passed a large statue nestled between some trees, and now I turn my head to look curiously back at the male figure's long, wavy beard, which is carved into thick, separate strands. I think it must be a statue of God in his Old Testament form of Jehovah, but he's smiling benignly. He also resembles the Greek god Poseidon, but I don't think either one is who the statue represents. I realize then that Carol is singing quietly and happily in the back seat. The melody is lovely, light, yet also rich and deep. I say, "Carol, this is a dream. We're dreaming, Carol." I look back at her, but she suddenly looks like a smaller version of the statue, which is very confusing because I was sure it was Carol sitting behind me. I say, "Who are you?" Then insist, "You are Carol." But the smiling figure with the serpent-like beard doesn't respond, so I hop off the vehicle, which has transformed into an old-fashioned open cart. I begin walking toward the brick structure, which is shaped like an upside-down L with the shorter section directly before me. The night air feels soft, and becoming conscious of my loose, full hair, I conjure a hairband between the fingers of my right hand. Containing my hair with it, I glance down at my body. I'm wearing a lacy white form-fitting shirt. I feel like I'm having an important lucid dream, but almost as soon as I reach the building, everything fades to black. I say, "No, I won't wake up." And pressing my palms against the wall, I wait until the scene reappears. Hanging before me now is a long and slender black metal bar with a hooked end. I become aware of it as it swings almost invitingly down in front of me. I know, almost as though it communicates the fact to me, that it can take me up where I want to go. Without a second thought, I grab the sharp, claw-like wrought iron, which immediately swings me up the wall to the edge of a red brick balcony. I'm glad it's a quick ride, because it actually hurts my dream hands to hold on to the sharp hook. Peering over the edge of a screened-in alcove, I can see beyond it into the interior of the building, which is lit with a clear light. Attractive and contentedly smiling young women walk gracefully by in white corsets. If this building really is a church, I seem to be glimpsing a radically different kind of convent attached to it. Just to my right on the balcony, a large black elevated metal platform, which curves like a crescent moon resting on its back, is swinging back and forth on long black chains. And inside this open cage kneel a man and a woman who seem to be having sex, but I more feel their presence than see them. I pull myself up over the edge of the wall and step into the balcony. Very deliberately, thinking this is a good way to stabilize the dream, I take a deep breath and slowly exhale it as I approach the object, then circle slowly around it. Sensing the black crescent is empty now, I climb into this strange metal boat that continues swinging back and forth like the pendulum of a massive clock. Slightly above me, a woman is sitting between the illuminated interior of the building and the shadowy balcony. She's very close and smiling down at me. Feeling she might be a figure of authority in this place, I ask her, "What's this for?" as I swing back and forth. She says, "It's for fucking." And without thinking, I reply, I want some of that." But then, as I question my response, the swing stops. Looking up at her and at the kinky convent beyond, I murmur, "No, I don't. I want Steve." Still smiling down at me in a knowing way, the woman casually reaches to her right and picks up a black leather object, one of a collection I glimpse stored in the space between this alcove and the interior of the building. Holding up a whip, she says, "This is what you can have of God." And I silently feel her telling me this is a way for me to experience a taste of God's transcendent power while still in my flesh. But although I comprehend, I cry out in disbelief, "The toys of God?" and slowly lose the dream. Carol and I spent nearly an entire day at Cairo's Palace of Retail. Festival City Mall is built around an immense outdoor fountain, which adjoins an outdoor movie theater of tiered stone seats. According to Carol, the city's most popular mall is even more crowded after sunset, when the Egyptian obsession with colorful lights is in full swing, inside and out. Despite names like Victoria's Secret and TGI Fridays, I never forgot I was in Egypt as we explored three spiraling floors. Above them all hung giant yet delicate silvery blue rings, some large, others smaller, and ascending one over the other in a way that made me think of planetary ellipses, string theory, and parallel universes. As we were walking by Victoria's Secret, I slowed down, drawn into its seductive orbit as I remembered the lacy white bodice-like shirt I had been wearing in my dream. I realized then it had resembled the white corsets the beautiful young women strolling through that mysteriously kinky convent had been wearing. I had not actually seen them, but I remembered sensing the presence of handsome, shirtless men wearing tight black leather pants. I imagined the confidently smiling women were on their way to meet with them somewhere in the building. Carol called over her shoulder, "Come on, Mary," and I realized she had quickened her pace even as I slowed down as we walked past this consumer chapel devoted to sensuality and sex. Remembering a Victoria's Secret bra made entirely of diamonds that had sold for millions, I caught up with my friend, who would soon be looking for attractive maternity outfits. They were called fantasy bras, but how many starving children could eat for a year from the sale of just one of them was painfully real. Carol announced abruptly, "I'm going to call my parents today." "Okay. I'll tell them I'm in love and engaged, but not that I'm pregnant. Not yet." "Good plan." My own parents had asked me not to go crazy buying souvenirs in Egypt, but they hadn't mentioned clothes, sandals, body lotions, or jewelry. Still, I was uncomfortably conscious of every charge I made on my credit card as I wondered just how Mom and Dad would react to my plan to remain in Egypt. Would they believe I was really in love? Probably not. It was much more likely they'd believe I was just enthusiastically following in Carol's footsteps with Simon's handsome young assistant. They would argue calmly and rationally and make a powerfully united case for me flying home and thinking things over, etc., and so forth. All I could say in my defense was, "But I'm in love. Really, I am." Knowing the evidence was stacked against me, anyone on the outside would perceive me as behaving rashly, impulsively, and disastrously in danger of murdering the future so lovingly and financially planned out for me. But my parents would, of course, have to meet Steve, and this was the fact that helped keep me relaxed. Because there could be no more credible witness to the truth that I wasn't making a stupid mistake than the reason I wanted to remain in Egypt. Stefano Guardini. I was still debating whether or not to tell Steve about my latest lucid dream when Hamoud drove me to the dock where I was meeting my new boyfriend for a romantic river boat ride on the Nile after dark. "Shukran," I said, quickly opening the back door for myself and stepping out onto the sidewalk. Its motor purring contentedly, the big blue car did not move as I looked around me. A flight of steps led down to a row of 5 medium-sized boats facing a wooden dock. People were already seated inside them, on a cushioned bench that ran along the insides. One boat appeared to be exclusively reserved for couples, which was nice, but there was no sign of Steve. It wasn't like him to be late, and I immediately began to worry. But Simon hadn't made the discovery of a lifetime, not yet anyway. There was no reason for me to be afraid nasty men had once again intercepted Steve to try and beat the secret location of Imhotep's tomb out of him. So I concentrated on the view, comforted by the fact that Hamoud would not leave until I was safely accompanied. The boat's ceilings, crisscrossed slender metal rods leaving rectangular openings, were decorated with colorful strings of lights, as were the sides. 2 boats featured a red and blue theme, the others were yellow and green. Behind them, the river was the silvery metallic gray that in Luxor had reminded me of a sword, slowly being tarnished by darkness. Across the water, the sun had set, and silhouetted against the soft orange sky was the tall black spire of a mosque, below which were docked much larger boats, all lit up like Christmas trees. Traffic hissed and rumbled behind me. An ideally temperate breeze rustled the leaves of identically sized palm trees lining the sidewalk like living columns, the gentle sound occasionally overwhelmed by bursts of loud music pouring out of passing cars. And the longer I stood there, the more alone I felt. I was in Egypt, but there was no magic in this thought or in the scene, only a sense of emptiness and waiting. And the longer I waited, the more I was possessed by the fear that I had only dreamed of Steve and how we felt about each other. I knew it was silly, even irrational, but at the moment, my panicking emotions were akin to a pack of baying dogs on the scent of some deep primordial dread that true love was only an illusion reality would make short work of, and then off to the next ultimately futile hunt. A deep, tired voice behind me said, "Paperwork is death." Turning joyfully around, I flung my arms around Steve's neck. "Don't tell that to my parents," I said, and then regretted it, thinking it was way too soon to mention them. Steve pulled me tightly against him.
"I'm sorry I'm late."
"That's okay."
"Come on."
He took my hand.
"Our boat's getting ready to shove off."
Moments later, I felt happy as a genie sitting comfortably in my bottle, floating across the Nile, granted everything I had ever wished for. As night fell, temples of golden columns rose on both sides of the river, while the lights of Cairo bloomed to full resplendent life. Our small boat was like a small red and blue flower adrift on the dark water, the couple sitting close together, its individual stamens, soft, private conversations drifting over the deck an invisible pollen. Gazing out at this most magical of cities, I said very softly, "Thank you."
Steve whispered, "Are you talking to me?"
"Yes, and my angel, too."
"We do seem to work well together."
Laughing, I decided that just holding one of his hands wasn't enough. Snuggling up to him, I encouraged him to slip an arm over my shoulders so I could rest more comfortably against his chest. Kissing the top of my head, he murmured,
"I like you there."
"I'm glad. So, Simon has you buried in paperwork?"
He groaned. "Let's talk about something else, please."
"What would you like to talk about?"
"Us."
I smiled. "That's my favorite subject."
"I'm due for a little vacation soon, and I was thinking it would be nice for us to fly down to Aswan. From there, we could take a 4-day river cruise to Luxor. We'll pass the island of Philae with its famous Ptolemaic temple to Isis, the wife of Osiris who was revered there from the very beginning."
"I would love that, Steve."
"Egyptologists believe Philae was the last bastion of the ancient Egyptian religion, and that the very last hieroglyph was written there. The temple was officially closed in the 6th century by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I, and a church was built around an ancient chapel of Osiris.
I said hesitantly, "The god of death and resurrection."
"You're thinking Jesus is just another myth?"
Before I could answer, he went on in the same relaxed tone.
I thought the same thing myself, until my dreams really began challenging me, and I began doing some reading. I'll never forget reading this sentence written by C.S. Lewis. "Christianity is a myth, which is also a fact." He describes the old myth of the dying god as coming down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. The death and resurrection happens at a particular date in a particular place and are followed by definable historical consequences. From gods like Osiris dying nobody knows when or where, we pass to a historical person crucified under Pontius Pilate. The miracle is that the myth becomes fact.
I said, "I believe it," remembering how I had felt Jesus speak to me yesterday through the Bible, but I didn't mention it. I wasn't even remotely ready to talk about it yet. I was afraid to. Not because I was afraid Steve wouldn't believe me, but because the experience was too special, too intimate, too incredibly personal, and so precious, I was afraid that if I spoke of it out loud, it would burst like a bubble the instant it came into contact with seemingly objective reality.
Then, of course, there's Kamambo, Nubt in ancient Egyptian, which means city of gold. Both temples there also date to the Ptolemaic era, but are worth visiting.
And we'll also stop at the Temple of Horus in Edfu? I asked eagerly.
Of course. And when we reach Luxor, we can visit Seti's temple, which we didn't get a chance to see last time.
And we'll take the sleeper train back to Cairo? I tried not to sound too excited by the thought of sharing a compartment with him.
We may have to fly. It all depends on when Simon needs me back.
Even though all you found was a single papyrus?
Yes, but what a papyrus, Mary. The more genetic techniques are used to investigate the medicinal plants of ancient Egypt, the more obvious it becomes the Egyptians, not the Greeks, were the true fathers of medicine. The medical papyrus we found in that apparently empty chamber is the oldest one ever discovered in Egypt.
Is it true, Steve, that many of the ancient Egyptian remedies we already know about are still used today, except mostly with synthetically produced ingredients instead of the natural ones?
It's true, and Simon's already been inundated with emails from doctors across the world, all of which I have to read and reply to, because he's too busy being wined and dined and offered more funds for further digging than he ever dreamed of.
Wow, I'm so happy for him, and for Carol. She's already mentioned something about an apartment in Mahdi. But I really love your place, Steve. I can't believe you have a view of the pyramids from your balcony.
The neighborhood is a tourist trap, but that's the reason the Wi-Fi works more often than not, and we don't lose power on a regular basis. Mohammed turned it into an Airbnb a few years ago. I stayed there when I first arrived in Egypt. I was planning to move somewhere more atmospheric, but it never happened.
I'm glad, Steve, because I love it. He was silent a moment before he said quietly,
"It's good for now."
With my body pressed against his, I felt everything he didn't say, and I sighed, feeling happier than I ever had in my life. I felt that way a lot lately. Suddenly, the excitement building inside me became tainted by anxiety, and I felt compelled to fasten my emotional seatbelt, as if Steve and I were sitting in a car moving slowly up the incline of a roller coaster. We were on the same track now, but what if it split up ahead because I wanted to go faster than he did? During that long, romantic boat ride on the Nile, I had plenty of time to tell him about the lucid dream I had had last night, but I didn't. I told myself I had to think about it some more first. I also didn't want him to get tired of hearing about my dreams, but I knew these excuses were no more substantial than the columns of light reflected on the water. The truth was, I couldn't bring myself to confess how intrigued I still was by those confidently smiling women walking through a mysteriously kinky convent. I was also haunted by the way that woman holding a whip had smiled at me and said, "This is what you can have of God." But more than anything, I was amazed by the cry that had sprung from me. The toys of God? In a manner I was beginning to realize was natural in lucid dreams, like my soul speaking without going through my brain first. Did God have toys? It was such a radical thought, I was becoming enamored of it. Whips, blindfolds, riding crops, black leather masks, these were all toys for grown-ups. After all, how could God be a prude if he created sex in the first place? Chapter 3. The next morning, I nearly collided with an angel of heaven on the threshold of my bedroom, Hamoud's youngest daughter, Laiba, for that was the meaning of her lovely name. Laiba had temporarily taken her mother's place as the apartment's maid and laundress. She was 16, and her face, framed by a different hijab every day, made me think of a flower's soft golden heart. Her smiles were usually brief flashes, burning with delight and curiosity, too soon cut off by a shy reserve that made me feel a lot more than 2 years older. One of her sisters had just had a baby, and their mother, Atsi, Hamoud's wife, was helping her out for a while. Today, Laiba's top headscarf was white and the bottom one a soft blue that matched her knee-length shirt and blue jeans, and the pins holding the scarves in place were also a matching blue and white. She was fresh out of high school and planning to go to university, although she wasn't sure what she wanted to study yet, just like me. Her English was very good, much better than her father's, but she didn't say much, and I personally found it a little embarrassing to have a girl nearly my own age making my bed and cleaning my room. Carol and I were both excited when we climbed into the back seat of Laiba's dad's big blue car, because we were headed to Mahdi and an apartment Simon had asked her to check out for them. I liked that Mahdi was the area's ancient name, which, thanks to her fiancé and boss, Carol knew was rich in pre-dynastic artifacts, many of which had been lost as the area was built up. Mahdi was upriver from downtown Cairo, a wealthy tree-filled district on the east bank that ran parallel to the Corniche. Embassies, international schools, sporting clubs, and cultural institutions could all be found in Mahdi. The residential high-rises were concentrated around the Corniche, and it was at the entrance to one of them that Hamoud dropped us off as he went in search of a place to park. I almost had to run to keep up with Carol. She was so excited about the 2,300 square feet she might have to work with. She had convinced Simon not to rent an already furnished apartment. He did not argue. At the moment, Imhotep's unfurnished tomb was all he had the time and energy to think about, and his artistic fiancé was awarded a completely blank canvas with which to work her creative magic. Thankfully, Imhotep would be helping to finance her creativity. I was thrilled for her, and myself as well, since I would be enjoying the results, and fully intended to contribute some ideas, especially concerning the guest room. The building's boab was wearing a suit, and he seemed a bit in awe of and unnerved by Carol, whose slender, delicate prettiness was strikingly at odds with the swiftness of her stride, an almost whirlwind energy as she flew through the apartment, like a huge hummingbird swiftly sampling each space and its potential creative flowering, before deciding the apartment as a whole deserved further consideration. Naturally, she headed straight for the master bathroom, while I began my tour in the kitchen. It was lovely. Shiny speckled granite counters with polished mahogany cabinets and a double stainless steel sink, a good-sized refrigerator, and its own wooden door. The fact that Carol did not immediately walk out of the bathroom indicated that the bathtub had met with her approval, and once she slowed down, I joined her in walking through the place. The balcony accessible from both the large living room and the equally spacious master bedroom, which could be either hidden or revealed by sliding wooden doors, boasted a glorious view of the Nile and, almost directly below, of the Corniche, which would be splendidly lit up at night. I could easily imagine the four of us, Carol and Simon, Steve and me, sitting out there watching the sunset across the river as we sipped wine and enjoyed an appetizer or two as dinner cooked in the oven. The walls of the master bedroom were a sky blue, and on the other side of the house, one bedroom was a warm rose hue and the other a lovely violet, my favorite color. The floors were golden and highly polished wooden tiles. The only strange detail was the washing machine in the master bathroom, yet there was no dryer to be found anywhere. We later discovered this was normal for Egypt. The balcony railing running the length of the apartment would come in handy, and I wondered if Carol was already feeling grateful for disposable diapers. Carol was much better at hiding her emotions behind a cool little smile. Although the Boab might have mistaken my gasps of delight for ones of shocked displeasure, I rather doubted it. So I controlled myself, not wanting the Simsar to raise the rent on Simon so that he couldn't afford the place. At $1,200 a month, it was a total steal. A tiny apartment in Boston could cost that much and more. When we were back in the car, I cried, "Location, location, location! Egypt, Cairo, and overlooking the Nile. A dream come true!" "Be quiet, Mary." Carol was thinking. Her jaw always locked up a little when she was doing that, and her eyes, staring straight ahead of her, were focused somewhere else entirely. "I'll shut up if you tell me you loved it and that the violet room will be for guests." She glanced at me in surprise. "The rose-colored room is obviously for baby." I didn't see Steve that night. It was my fault. I had told him over dinner, after our lovely boat ride together, that I didn't want him to feel obliged to keep me entertained, that I knew he was working long hours, and it was perfectly all right with me if he felt like going straight home after work and enjoying some private time before catching up on his sleep. I liked that he hadn't asked me if I was sure, but simply said,
"Thank you, Mary. I'll do that. It'll also give me time to arrange our tour. We'll be leaving soon."
The following day, I finally saw Simon again at As-Salam International Hospital, an ultra-modern state-of-the-art facility located on the Nile Corniche in Mahdi, on a peninsula-like section, which meant it was surrounded by water. It was, hands down, the brightest and most colorful hospital I had ever been in. The white walls and pearl-gray floors were given life by bands of yellow-gold paint above shining stainless steel guardrails, beneath which were raised lapis lazuli blue panels. And the one room I caught a glimpse of looked more like a hotel room, with its walls painted a lovely blue and white, a smart contrast to the faux mahogany cabinets over the bed, beside which sat a comfortable-looking blue chair overlooking the river. Even being sick in Egypt looked like it might be less depressing than anywhere else. I had accompanied Carol, who was feeling both nervous and excited about her first ultrasound. Simon met us in the lobby, and I was surprised when he swept my friend up into his arms and hugged her so fiercely I almost worried for the baby. I had never seen such a straightforward display of emotion from the rather sarcastic Egyptologist. But then again, believing as he did that life was confined to biology, this hospital was the equivalent of a cathedral for him. He and my friend would not be getting married in a church, and not just because Simon was an atheist, and Carol... It was still a mystery to me what my friend believed or didn't believe. I knew she believed in the magic pattern, but that was about all I knew. She was silent as a cat on the subject of God. But right now I was more curious about the logistics of two American citizens getting married in Egypt, for very personal reasons. According to the U.S. Embassy website, the only legal marriage for foreigners in Egypt is a civil ceremony performed at the local marriage court in accordance with Islamic practice. Persons wishing a religious ceremony can arrange for one separately, but it's the civil ceremony that establishes the legal marriage. Egyptian authorities require all foreigners, including U.S. citizens, to provide written proof there's no legal impediment to their marriage, which means notarized sworn statements at the U.S. Embassy, and, of course, a legal passport, other IDs, a medical checkup, a valid visa, etc. I wondered who Simon would ask to be the other male witness required at the ceremony, because, as a woman, I was not qualified. When Carol's name was called, I followed behind her and Simon, all of us on our way to personally experience a very common miracle. The Egyptologist and I had to endure another smaller waiting room until Carol had been prepped and was ready for us. I'll never forget the way she smiled at us as we entered the room and told Simon in a hushed voice, "I can hear our baby's heart beating." I looked over at the monitor, where I saw what appeared to be an ancient Egyptian floral collar made of silver and blue metal. narrow at the top and widening out as though the surrounding darkness hid the person wearing it. Near the base of this luminous collar, inside a black hole shaped roughly like an eye, floated a vague little shape in the center of which a tiny heart beat so fast and strong it almost appeared to be dancing. I moved closer, barely aware of the smiling nurse seated to one side of Carol, and was able to make out the shape of a head with an emoticon's eyes and smile above an amorphous little body from which sprouted tiny circles that were the beginnings of hands and feet. Simon said,
"It looks like a gummy bear."
I wanted to kill him until Carol laughed, and then the way he reached for her hand as they gazed into each other's eyes made it easy for me to completely forgive him. Wearing blue surgical gloves, the nurse began typing, "Hi, Mommy and Daddy," but becoming aware that she was the only one smiling at the fake message appearing on the screen, she quickly deleted it and happily informed the father that his baby was, give or take a day or two, 8 weeks old. I get ready to leave a building. At the end of the broad corridor, wide double doors open as I approach them. It's night outside, but I'm still able to discern a lioness only a few feet away, reclining on a low stone wall looking at me. I immediately head back inside, and turning left around a corner, I warn someone, "Don't go outside! There's a lion out there!" Then I enter a dark room that somehow feels like it belongs to me. Through a window, I can see the lioness still reclining on the ledge and looking in at me. I know now this is a dream and that I'm not going to run because I have to face this. She can't really hurt me, but she can get in, and I can't stop her. So I just stand there as she jumps onto the window ledge and passes through the glass barrier as if it isn't even there. She comes to stand beside me in the dark room, and placing my hands on her head, I say, "I love you." She slinks fondly, warmly around me, and I declare, "You're so beautiful." Rolling ecstatically onto her back, she grows larger as she transforms into a male lion. Crouching down to scratch his silky, furry belly and caress his soft, rich mane, I repeat over and over again, "You're so beautiful. So beautiful." We're literally wallowing in the immense pleasure of getting to know each other. As I pet him, I wonder what it would be like to be a lion myself. And thinking about it, I see and feel my hands transform into large, fluffy paws as our mutual ardor increases. And now, it's almost like I'm a lioness making love with this lion, only we're doing it human style, facing each other. Over breakfast, I told Carol, "I had the craziest lucid dream last night."
"And I'm sure you want to talk about it."
"Only if you're interested. I'd hate to bore you with these amazingly fully conscious experiences I'm having while asleep." Twirling her teabag around and around, she studied my face a moment before inquiring, "So why is it, do you think, that you're all of a sudden having these amazing lucid dreams?" "That night we camped out in Amos's tomb, Steve told me he became a disciple of Christ because of his lucid dreams. And now you're dating him and lucid dreaming, and there's a Bible in your room. It's pretty, I don't know, weird." "I think a more appropriate adjective is awesome," she admitted reluctantly. "I barely remember my dreams." "That's a shame, considering what a great sleeper you are." I sighed dramatically. "All that time wasted." "Mary, do you really want to read the Bible, or are you just doing it to please Steve?" "Yes and no." I couldn't get angry with her, because she knew perfectly well that I had a tendency to suddenly become interested in whatever my boyfriend was seriously into. But I didn't see this as a bad thing. I thought of it as having an open mind and a healthy curiosity and a desire to expand my horizons. "Yes, I want to please Steve, but no, that's not the main reason I'm reading the Bible, the New Testament, to be precise, you know, the Gospels. I want to read them, and my lucid dreams have a lot to do with how much I want to. My dreams are directly related to this growing desire in me to know more about Jesus, who actually said he was God. So either he was a complete nut job, or he really was God, is God.
He was a great teacher. Dipping her toast into her tea, she took a soggy bite.
Didn't you hear me, Carol? Jesus said he was God. So if he really wasn't God, he was either the most pathological of liars or batshit crazy. You can't be a great teacher if you're insane.
Leaning toward me, she whispered, Mary, please stop yelling. Liba's here and she's going to think you're crazy.
I don't care.
Just tell me your dream, Mary, she urged soothingly, but without yelling, please.
You know what, Carol?
I stared at her and meant it when I said, you're going to be a great mother. She sat back in surprise, but then smiled in that humbly uncertain, yet also intensely hopeful way of hers I loved so much. Do you really think so? She glanced down at her invisible baby.
No doubt about it.
Thank you. Her eyes watered. I love you, Mary. I'm so glad you're here.
I love you, too.
I blinked away hot tears.
Do you remember the time your mom nearly killed us for ransacking the linen closet to make a tent so we could pretend to be Arabian princesses?
Wiping her eyes, she smiled. I remember.
Well, a luxury high-rise apartment overlooking the Nile is even better than a tent.
But mentioning her mother had made me remember something. Carol, what did your parents say when you called them? When are they coming? Downing her tea, she reached for my empty plate. I haven't called them yet. There's time. She disappeared into the kitchen with the dirty dishes.
I yelled after her, I think I saw Aslan in my lucid dream last night.
Holding a sponge, she reappeared in the doorway. I had her attention now, because we both loved the Chronicles of Narnia.
Carol, it was like being Susan or Lucy hugging and petting Aslan. He was so beautiful, and I loved him so much. And he loved me. It was a total love fest. And then I became a lioness, and...
And what?
We began making love, but facing each other like people. We didn't fuck like animals. We were making love. Yet it wasn't a physical sensation. It was like we were merging into the love flowing between us.
Are you telling me that in your lucid dream last night, you had sex with a lion? Cradling an armful of laundry, Liba stepped out of the corridor leading to the bedrooms. Carol muttered, Oh, God, and vanished into the kitchen. Pushing my chair back, I got up as I cried,
Marhabahan, Liba.
Marhabahan, Mary, she replied politely, but didn't smile.
Chapter 4.
It was Saturday, so a little while after breakfast, Hamoud drove me to Steve's apartment. I ran up the front steps of the building before any of the professional tour guides hovering around it could intercept me. I made my way up the staircase against the current of tourists streaming down. It was comforting yet also strange to be surrounded by American voices, one of them a woman's complaining about the lack of a dryer in the apartment. I nearly bumped into several people staring down at their phones who never even saw me. Steve's apartment was on the fourth floor. I knocked loudly three times. The place was tiny, so when after about a minute nothing happened, I pulled out the key he had given me and let myself in. I was a little early. I knew Steve was somewhere nearby, maybe up in the gym, where the treadmills facing the window had a stunning close-up view of the pyramids, rising just behind the rose, yellow, and white rooftops of this lovely, clean, nearly power-outage-free neighborhood whose lifeblood was tourism. He had given me his key after our boat ride, when we were having dinner at a little place a block away from his building. It had been a thrilling moment when he handed me his key that had made my heart sprint toward a future moment when it was a ring he was offering me. But it was only a key. It would be convenient for me to have, and for him as well. That way, if he was running late or felt like lifting a few more weights, he didn't have to worry about me fretting on his doorstep. Still,
I treasured this totally ordinary-looking key like a priceless artifact in the history of my life. The apartment's best feature was the little balcony opening off the combined living room and kitchen area, to one side of which was the bedroom and its tiny adjoining bathroom. I knew, because Steve had told me, that the only item of furniture belonging to him was the tall, narrow bookcase he had bought because it would fit between the balcony and bedroom doors. Some books, he said, you had to have a physical version of, such as atlases, field manuals, rare books not yet digitized, and, of course, the Holy Bible. This was only the second time I had been here, and I relished having the little space all to myself for a few minutes as I soaked up the sense of his presence and personality, mysteriously lingering in the molecules of the air. The first time he had brought me here, we had sat together on the sand-colored couch as I told him my dream, in which I had cried, "Calling all watchers, 2012 has begun," even though it was already 2017. That's when he'd gotten up and brought his Bible over, and opening it at the end instead of the beginning, flipped back a couple pages to read me Revelation 20:12. Now that was a moment I would never forget. What a difference a tiny bit of punctuation could make. I never would have thought a simple colon could change my life. This event had impressed upon me the need for knowledge, to keep learning, because not being familiar with how verses and lines in Scripture are referred to, my dream made no sense. But the day was too beautiful and I was too happy to think about skeletal wraiths the color of ashes gathering like storm clouds blocking out the sun, and how this might relate to the end of the world and Judgment Day. Nope, that was definitely not on the agenda on this particular day, thank you. I was in Egypt and in love, and life stretched out before me in a brilliant haze of possibilities. However, it was exciting to wonder who my fellow watchers might be, and what we were watching for, and why. This was an intriguing mystery I looked forward to exploring, but, again, not this morning. After checking my makeup in the little bathroom mirror, I stepped outside onto the narrow balcony, furnished with a small round black plastic table and two matching chairs. I looked forward to this evening, when Steve and I would be sitting out here, sipping wine and talking as the sun set behind the pyramids. But that was still hours away, and first we were going out to lunch, then somewhere else he wanted to take me. When I heard the apartment door open, I remained out on the porch. I had locked the door behind me, and right away I sensed Steve didn't realize I was here. He was shirtless, there was a white towel around his neck, and his loose workout shorts covered only the tops of his thighs. My breath caught, because, like the first time I had seen him, I felt there was something timelessly beautiful about him. A similarly thick, protective white cloth had been worn by bare-chested, tall, and slender ancient Egyptian men working out in the fields. It was also the hieroglyph that spelled Sa, the word for protection, because it protected the place at the back of the neck where the spinal cord merges with the brainstem. Aware that a wound there would cause instant death or paralysis, the ancient Egyptians had been wise enough to protect that particularly vulnerable area of their body. The ancient Egyptians had been a fascinating blend of sensible efficiency and metaphysical intensity, like Steve, who believed in protection, not just for the body, but for the soul. He had said I was protected because I was baptized. Part of me still wanted to think he was only speaking symbolically, but I knew he wasn't. He was a Catholic, and he believed in the power of the sacraments to affect our soul's health, and therefore also our physical well-being. Watching him without his knowledge as he strode into the kitchen and poured himself a tall glass of water, I grasped another reason I was so attracted to him, and felt both comfortable and energized in his presence. Because he really believed in God, who was infinitely greater than us, but who had created us in his image. This supreme humility and confidence were the opposite of vain pride. His movements, his every gesture, how he carried himself, was a living hieroglyph spelling all this out to me as I feasted on the sight of him. When he glanced at his watch and looked at the front door, I quickly stepped into the apartment,
Hi. I got here early, but please, feel free to shower. And I felt free to suggest it because I wasn't worried he would teasingly ask me to join him.
If you could smell me all the way out there, he grinned.